Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining me today for Readings of Interest to the Jewish Community. My name is Michael Wolin. I'm going to start with a Dvar Torah today, some commentary by Rabbi Yonatan Sacks, former chief rabbi of Great Britain. And he's commenting on Parsha, or portion, Vayechel. He titles this God's Shadow. Now, in this Parsha, we are still in the book of Exodus. In this Parsha, we meet for the second time the man who became the symbol of the artist in Judaism, a man by the name of Bezalel. Then Moses said to the Israelites, "Know that the Lord has chosen Bezalel, son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah, and has filled him with a divine spirit of wisdom, understanding, and knowledge in every craft, to make artistic designs for work in gold, silver, and bronze, as well as cutting stones for setting, carving wood, engaging in every other craft. He has also given him the ability to teach others, together with Oholiab, son of Afsimach of the tribe of Dan. He has filled them with the skill to do all kinds of work as engravers, designers, embroiderers in sky blue, purple, or scarlet wool, or fine linen, and as weavers. They will be able to carry out all the necessary work and design." Well, that was from our Parsha, Exodus chapter 35, verses 30 and 35. It would be Bezalel, together with Oholiab, who would make the tabernacle and its furnishings, and be celebrated through the centuries as the inspired craftsman who used his skill for the greater glory of God. The aesthetic dimensions of Judaism has tended to be downplayed, at least until the modern era, for obvious reasons. The Israelites worshiped the invisible God who transcended the universe, not the human person. And other than the human person, God has no image, even when he revealed himself to the people at Sinai. "You heard the sound of words, but saw no image. There was only a voice." From Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 12. Given the intense connection, until around the 18th century, between art and religion, image making was seen as potentially idolatrous, hence the second of the Ten Commandments. "Do not make for yourself any carved image or likeness of in the form of any creature in heaven above or the earth beneath, or in the waters below," from Exodus chapter 20, verse 4. This concern continued long after the biblical era. The Greeks, who achieved unrivaled excellence in the visual arts, were, in the religious sphere, still a pagan people of myth and mystery, while the Romans had a disturbing tendency to turn Caesars into gods and erect statues to them. However, the visual dimension was not wholly missing from Judaism. There are visible symbols like tzitzit and tefillin. There is, according to the sages, a meta mitzvah known as hidur mitzvah, beautifying the command, to try to ensure that all objects used in the performance of a command are as beautiful as possible. The most significant intrusion of the aesthetic dimension was in the tabernacle itself, its framework and hangings, its furniture, the cherubim above the ark, the menorah, and the vestments of the priests and the high priest, lekavod uletiferet, for dignity and for beauty. That's explained in Exodus chapter 28, verse 2. Maimonides, in The Guide for the Perplexed, says that most people are influenced by aesthetic considerations, which is why the sanctuary was designed to inspire admiration and awe, why a continual light burned there, why the priestly robes were so impressive, why there was music in the form of the Levitical choir, and why incense was burned to cover the smell of the sacrifices. Maimonides himself, in the work known as the Eight Chapters, the introduction to his commentary on the Mishnah Avot, speaks about the therapeutic power of beauty and its importance in counteracting depression. Someone afflicted with melancholy may dispel it by listening to music and various kinds of song, by strolling in gardens, by experiencing beautiful buildings, by associating with beautiful pictures and similar sorts of things that broaden the soul. Now that's Maimonides' writing in the Eight Chapters, Chapter 5. Art, in short, is balm to the soul. In modern times, the thinker who spoke most eloquently about aesthetics was Rav Kook. In his commentary to the Siddur, he wrote, "Literature, painting, and sculpture give material expression to all the spiritual concepts implanted in the depths of the human soul. And as long as even one single line hidden in the depths of the soul has not been given outward expression, it is the task of art, that is Avodat HaUmanut, to bring it out." Well, this is Rav Kook in his commentary to the Siddur. It's called Olat Re'ayah, chapter 2, verse 3. Evidently, these remarks were considered controversial. So in later editions of the commentary, the phrase literature, painting, and sculpture was removed, and in its place was written literature, its design, and tapestry. The name Bezalel was adopted by the artist Boris Schatz for the School of Arts and Crafts, which he founded in Israel in 1906, and Rav Kook wrote a touching letter in support of its creation. He saw the renaissance of art in the Holy Land as a symbol of the regeneration of the Jewish people in its own land, landscape, and birthplace. Judaism in the diaspora, removed from a natural connection with its own historic environment, was inevitably cerebral and spiritual. Alienated, only in Israel would an authentic Jewish aesthetic emerge, strengthened by and in turn strengthening Jewish spirituality. Perhaps the most moving of all remarks Rav Kook made about art came in the course of a conversation he had with a Jewish sculptor. He said, "When I lived in London, I used to visit the National Gallery, and my favorite pictures were those of Rembrandt. I really think Rembrandt was a tzaddik. Do you know that when I first saw Rembrandt's works, they reminded me of the rabbinic statement about the creation of light? We are told that when God created light on the first day of creation, as opposed to the natural light of the sun on the fourth day, it was so strong and pellucid that one could see from one end of the world to the other. But God was afraid that the wicked might abuse it. What did he do? He reserved that light for the righteous in the world to come. But now and then there are great men who are blessed and privileged to see it. I think that Rembrandt was one of them, and the light in his pictures is the very light that God created on Genesis Day." End quote. I've often wondered what it was about Rembrandt's paintings that so enthralled the Rav. Rembrandt lived in the Jewish quarter of Amsterdam, knew Jews and painted them, as well as painting many biblical scenes, though the closeness or otherwise of his connection with Jews has been the subject of controversy. Rav Kook's admiration for the artist had, I suspect, nothing to do with this, and everything to do with the light Rembrandt saw in the faces of ordinary people, without any attempt to beautify them. His work let us see the transcendental quality of the human, the only thing in the universe on which God set his image. Art, in Hebrew, omanut, has a semantic connection with emunah, or faith, or faithfulness. A true artist is faithful both to his materials and to the task, teaching us to see a world in a grain of sand, and a heaven in a wild flower. Hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour. That's from William Blake, from Auguries of Innocence. The name Petzalel means in the shadow of God. Art is the shadow cast by the radiance of God that suffuses all things. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It's a quote by Gerard Manley Hopkins in his work From God's Grandeur. And as Goethe said, where there is much light, the shadow is deep. When art lets us see the wonder of creation as God's work and the human person as God's image, it becomes a powerful part of the religious life, with one proviso. The Greeks believed in the holiness of beauty. Jews believe in Hadrat Kodesh, the beauty of holiness. Not art for art's sake, but art as a disclosure of the ultimate artistry of the Creator. That is how omanut enhances emunah, how art adds wonder to faith. All kinds of things in the Torah. These comments are derived from Exodus, Book of Exodus, Parsha Vayechel, titled In God's Shadow. That's by Rabbi Yonatan Sacks. Well, I want to turn a little bit here to some contemporary things. I think everybody's heard or heard about President Biden's State of the Union address. And interestingly, there's some comment about it that I think is relevant to Jewish people. This is a commentary by Jonathan Tobin, who's editor-in-chief of the Jewish News Syndicate. He says the president's hyper-partisan address had more harsh words for Israel than Hamas, for whom he offered a floating pier. He said not a word about surging anti-Semitism. In an age which partisanship is greater than ever, opinions about the quality of the annual report by the president to the Congress, mandated by the United States Constitution, depends entirely on whether the listener shares the party affiliation of the person who lives in the White House. That means the Democrats regarded President Joe Biden's State of the Union address as feisty, truthful, and showed that he was not too old to serve and exactly what the country needed to hear. Republicans thought of it as angry, divisive, full of lies, and wondered whether the 81-year-old had relied on artificial help of some kind to get through the evening while speaking at a piece at a speed that was oddly faster than his usual pace. And if you saw his presentation or listened to it, you know that much faster than he usually presents himself. From a Jewish perspective, regardless of whether you are a Democrat or a Republican, the best one can always hope for in a State of the Union is when Jews and Israel never get a mention. When that happens, it's a clear indication that American Jews are largely safe and Israel is not involved in active conflict. That is not the case in 2024. Biden's speech, therefore, took on an added importance for those who care about Israel and the battle against anti-Semitism. And what he said and did not say spoke volumes about the dismal attitudes of his administration on each of those topics. Regardless of whether you support the Democrats or the Republicans, with respect to Jewish interests, Biden's State of the Union address was a disaster. While he deplored the October 7 attacks on Israel and even invited relatives of the hostage families to be in the gallery of the U.S. House of Representatives for the speech, the fact that he went on to have more harsh words for the democratically elected government of Israel than the terrorists of Hamas was shocking. So too was his unrealistic demand that Israel could wage a justified war against the Islamists without harming the Palestinian Hamas hides behind. And his demand that Israel accede to a Palestinian state at the end of the war is not only immoral, it will grant a reward to the terrorists and undermine United States interests throughout the region. His plans to deploy United States troops and resources to create a floating harbor to facilitate the delivery of aid to Gaza was an ill-thought-out idea that will likely do far more to help Hamas, which is certain to steal most of the supplies that the Americans will deliver, unless Biden foolishly breaks his promise and United States troops do land in the Gaza Strip. Worst of all, the president had not a single word to say about the unprecedented surge of anti-Semitism sweeping through America, driven by his erstwhile intersectional allies on the left wing of his party. While Biden denounced the atrocities of October 7 and demanded the release of the 134 hostages, those still living, languishing in tunnels, cages, and who knows where, most of his rhetorical attention was devoted to lecturing the Israeli government that its top priority should be to avoid harming Palestinian civilians. As Biden knows, the Israel Defense Forces takes greater care to do that than any other army in the world, including that of the United States. By harping on the issue, it's clear that the administration's declarations of support for Israel's right of self-defense are meaningless if the only way that it can be carried out is by a miraculous, immaculate campaign, which would be impossible even if Hamas wasn't deliberately using civilians as human shields. His demand for a ceasefire is not doing anything to help free the hostages. Hamas, which has once again rejected even the lopsided deal that Biden has been trying to force on Israel, has come to the not unreasonable conclusion that it should continue to hold out rather than surrender or agree to terms. The reason is that the terrorist organization believes that the pressure Biden is feeling from the angry intersectional left wing of the Democratic Party will lead to the Americans bailing it out by preventing Israel from finishing it off. Biden's discussion of the question of aid to Palestinians, especially those living in areas still under Hamas control, was even more troubling. Here again, he harshly lectured the Israeli government that it was responsible for the problems in getting supplies to Gaza residents in need. Yet, he failed to acknowledge that Hamas has been stealing most of the food, fuel, and other materials intended for civilians and keeping it for their terrorist forces and leadership hiding behind the population. Israel has actually been continuously allowing aid, even into areas controlled by their genocidal enemy, though it is trying to prevent them from using the convoys to resupply the terrorists and help them continue to kill. The plan to build a floating harbor for Gaza has so many potential pitfalls that it's hard to imagine how such an idea is being seriously considered, let alone implemented. The commitment of resources to what amounts to a replay of the D-Day invasion, Mulberry Harbor's used off Normandy in June of 1944, is considerable, especially when the United States military is being pushed to its limits by shortages created by Biden stripping it of resources to help Ukraine. The main point is that the massive quantity of supplies that will pour into Gaza as a result of this project are almost certain to end up in the hands of Hamas, unless there are, as Biden pledged there would not be, American boots on the ground there. The temptation to get involved in the distribution of what is brought ashore will be intolerable, despite the promises and danger to American forces from being caught up in a war in which they have no business. Israel can and wants to fight its own battles and only asks for the arms and ammunition it needs to defend itself. It's obvious. If Americans don't prevent Hamas from stealing these goods, what Biden is doing is creating a lifeline for an ally of Iran that is hell-bent on carrying out an endless war against both Israel's existence and the United States. It has all the earmarks of the same kind of foreign policy military disaster that marked Biden's handling of the withdrawal from Afghanistan, in that it will help America's enemies and hurt its allies, not to mention how it will harm America itself. Biden also used the speech to advocate for a two-state solution at the end of the war that Palestinians have continuously rejected because they refuse to live in peace with a Jewish state, no matter where its borders are drawn. The Hamas regime in Gaza, that was an independent Palestinian state in all but name for 16 years, was proof of what Israel could expect if this was replicated, as Biden insists on imposing the same scheme in the far larger and strategic areas of Judea and Samaria, and even dividing Jerusalem. The overwhelming majority of Israelis regard this not so much as unwise as insane. For Biden to insist on imposing this idea that has been tried and repeatedly failed by others throughout his decades in public service and public life shows that he has forgotten much and learned nothing in all of that time. What made this advocacy even more offensive was the way Biden trotted out his supposed credentials as the most pro-Israel American politician to date. He may be the only United States president to have visited Israel in wartime, but that war was the direct result of his appeasement of Hamas's Iranian sponsors. The invoking of his record in this matter is analogous to, as a Jew, critiques of Israel by Jews who only speak of their identity when it can be used to bash the Jewish state. No real friend of Israel speaks this way, and in truth, Biden's support has always been conditional on their people heeding his foolish, even suicidal advice, something the voters of Israel have consistently refused to do. For some strange reason, they don't want to commit suicide. But the most grievous failure of Biden's address with respect to the aftermath of October 7 is his failure to say one word about the surge in anti-Semitism during his presidency. October 7 didn't just present a threat to Israel. As it soon became clear, the attacks were also the pretext for a surge in anti-Semitism around the world, unlike anything seen since the end of World War II. Though often cloaked in alleged concerns for the suffering of Palestinians caught up in the war, Hamas launched, the veneer of human rights advocacy is tissue thin. As is readily apparent in the language they deploy, their goal is, like that of Hamas, the destruction of Israel and its people. Moreover, their tactics target Jews everywhere for harassment and attacks. If nothing else, October 7 has once again proved conclusively that the line some say separates anti-Zionism from anti-Semitism is a distinction without a difference. The engine of this anti-Semitism has been fueled by the ideas of the woke left, to which Biden has continuously bent his knee since he became president. The intersectional mindset of those indoctrinated in the myths of critical race theory divides the world into two warring groups, white oppressors and people of color, who are their victims. As has long been apparent, this is not just bad for America, as it heightens racial divisions and locks the country into an endless and immutable conflict. It also grants a permission slip for anti-Semitism, since Jews and Israel are invariably considered white oppressors, regardless of the realities about the Middle East or anything else. This has caused considerable political problems for Biden, since the focus of the protests has been to halt any American support for Israel. As a result, Biden has been working hard to appease anti-Israel and anti-Semitic voters in places like Dearborn, Michigan, the country's jihad capital, to whose pro-Hamas mayor he sent a high-ranking delegation of policymakers to apologize for any pro-Israel measures. Incredible. Biden should not have let this occasion go by without a strongly worded condemnation of anti-Semitism. Nevertheless, he had nothing to say about the mobs calling for Israel's destruction and terrorism against Jews everywhere that have become commonplace on college campuses and in the streets of American cities. Anti-Semitic invective has become equally pervasive in public discourse, including in many leading publications and broadcast outlets where the delegitimization of Israel and Zionism is now considered fair comment. This has caused even many liberal Jews to question their security and future in a country where, for good reason, they no longer feel secure. The reason for Biden's failure is obvious. Had he done so, he would have felt obligated to twin what concern or any concern about Jews with bogus claims about a rise in Islamophobia, though most of what is termed hatred for Muslims is nothing more than efforts to call out the rabid and vicious anti-Semitism in the Muslim community. Even if he had done that, it would have still been intolerable to the mobs in the streets, including those that held up the motorcade that brought him to Capitol Hill for his speech. And their supporters in Congress. They regard any mention of Jew hatred as a way to divert attention from their efforts to smear the Jewish state and its supporters. And in an address that even his backers conceded was more of a campaign speech to his base than anything else, talking about anti-Semitism was just not going to make the cut. Biden is foolish to think he has more votes to lose among anti-Semites than among Jews or the vast majority of Americans who stand by Israel and against anti-Semitism. But so strong is the grip of the intersectional wing of the party, that means the radical left of the party, on the White House, that he feels obligated to bash Israel and ignore the plague of Jew hatred spreading across the country on his watch. The State of the Union for Jews in 2024 is very shaky indeed. And that is no small measure due to Biden's implementation of the woke catechism of diversity, equity, and inclusion throughout the United States government, which is enabling a sea change in the culture that makes anti-Semitism inevitable. Were he serious about doing something about Jew hatred, He would reverse his decisions and begin to roll back the ideological underpinnings of the new anti-Semitism. But given his lack of understanding of the problem and political dependence on the forces that are spreading this hate, it's unimaginable. Sometimes what presidents don't say is as important as the words that pass through their lips. Biden's comments about the post-October 7 war against Hamas were lamentable and regrettable. But his failure to mention anti-Semitism in his annual address in the wake of October 7 is a moral failure that should not be forgotten. Well, these comments are from Jonathan Tobin, who is editor-in-chief of the Jewish News Syndicate. The moral failure of Biden's State of the Union address. Well, here's another one, somewhat related. President Biden, at any rate, is involved in it. I thought it was an incredible story. Not too long. On a hot mic, now that's a mic that's live and picks up whoever is speaking, but the speaker is unaware that it's there or unaware that it's picking him up. But on a hot mic, Biden says that Prime Minister Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of the Jewish State of Israel, needs to have a Come to Jesus meeting. The first meaning of the term, Come to Jesus, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, is designating a person or group of people who encourage others to accept Christianity. Well, okay. Some 22 minutes after he finished delivering the State of the Union address on Thursday night, U.S. President Joe Biden was caught on a hot mic saying that Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu must have a come-to-Jesus experience. Biden, who is Catholic, was talking about the Jewish leader with Senator Michael Bennett, Democrat from Colorado, and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, both of whom have Jewish ancestry, and with U.S. Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg, who is Christian. The audio was somewhat garbled, but Biden can be heard telling Bennett that he told Netanyahu that he had to have a come-to-Jesus moment. I told him, Bibi, and don't repeat this, but you and I are going to have a come-to-Jesus, Biden began as an aide rushed over to stop him from saying more, exclaiming, sir, and whispering in his ear. This is according to the New York Post. I'm on a hot mic here, Biden said out loud, adding sarcastically, good, that was good, the Post added. The Hill, the paper The Hill, quoted the president slightly differently. They said, quote, you and I are going to have a come to Jesus meeting, it reported Biden saying, adding he didn't want them to repeat what he said. An aide to Biden then appeared to inform the president that his microphone was still on. I'm on a hot mic here, Biden replied. Good, that's good, The Hill added. Well, asked the next day about the statement, Biden said, I didn't say that, according to the White House Pool report. A reporter asked the president whether he said it after his State of the Union address, and he replied, you guys eavesdropped on me. Okay, well, it's hard to imagine eavesdropping when you have the President of the United States speaking to scores, if not hundreds, of people assembled in the galley of the House of Representatives, but that's what he said. The Oxford English Dictionary defines the phrase, come to Jesus, as designating a person or group of people who encourage others to accept Christianity, of relating to or typical of such a person or group, usually with disparaging implication, that is, insincerely pious or hypocritical. The term can also refer to a meeting or a discussion, a counter or so on, that results or is intended to result in a significant shift in the current way of thinking about or doing something, involving or characterized by facing unpleasant facts and the making of important, difficult decisions, according to the Comprehensive Dictionary, or to a meeting, discussion, and so on, intended to settle a dispute or resolve a situation, an intense argument, or a showdown. Prior to Biden's hot mic declaration, Bennett said that he had told Blinken that he was recently in Jordan and Israel. "You gotta just keep pushing the humanitarian stuff," the senator told Biden, as Blinken nodded several times. Well, what they mean by this humanitarian stuff and a ceasefire and a pause is Hamas is losing and the White House will not tolerate that. It doesn't have much to do with Netanyahu, really. It has more to do with Biden and his administration's attitudes towards the Jews of Israel. And that includes, regrettably, our Secretary of State and also one of our Jewish senators, Senator Bennett from Colorado. Well, there you have it. Biden on a hot mic. Netanyahu needs to come to Jesus. Well, let's move on here. I have an article from the Wall Street Journal. This is concerning Hamas's agricultural terrorism. So we talk about getting humanitarian supplies to the poor, innocent Palestinians, 80% of whom supported Hamas's attack. But no mention that I've seen in the mainstream media, with the exception of this article found in the Wall Street Journal, about how the attack targeted Israel's food supply with the intent of breaking the community. This is written by Nahal Oz and it's Dateline Israel. For a week following Hamas's October 7 attack on Israel, the stench of 300,000 rotting chickens rose from Kibbutz Alumim, 2 miles from the Gaza border. 3 chicken coops were burned to the ground, but they weren't the source of the smell. Terrorists had destroyed the automated food and water dispensers for the remaining 5 structures housing the flock of birds. And after the attack, no one was there to tend to the chickens. The birds died of hunger and thirst, and their bodies decomposed. Residents who then returned to survey the damage wore masks as they scooped up and buried the corpses to prevent the spread of disease. The human tragedy on October 7 still grips the country and is compounded by another kind of devastation Hamas inflicted on Israel. Danielle Abraham, executive director of Volcani International Partnerships, a non-governmental organization that addresses global hunger using Israeli technological innovation, calls it agricultural terrorism. Terrorists targeted farmland, livestock, plants, and infrastructure as they made their way across the western Negev, which produces roughly 70% of the country's vegetables, 20% of its fruit, 6% of its milk. The attack was designed to intentionally destroy agricultural production. But more than that, it was meant to destroy the identity of the region, to break the community, Ms. Abraham said. Hamas terrorists damaged greenhouses and barns, many beyond repair. They slashed crop nets and flooded orchards. They burned irrigation pipes and shot at fertilization systems. They destroyed the filtration system for the local reservoir. Soil compaction and pollution from Israeli tanks brought in to expel the terrorists has also damaged roughly 10% of the area's land. Foreign nationals from countries such as Thailand, Nepal, and Tanzania, who were working the farms, returned to their native countries after the attacks, leaving many crops unharvested. Israel's Ministry of Agriculture and Rural Development anticipates this year's tomato harvest will be about 30% of its normal yield nationwide. Known for producing some of the world's sweetest tomatoes, Israel is now importing them. Lettuce and onion shortages are expected, and up to 20% of strawberry fields were abandoned. Estimates of income losses and infrastructure damage total more than $500 million. Moran Freibach, the agricultural manager of Nahal Oz, a kibbutz in the Negev, spoke to a group of American philanthropists visiting Israel on February 6. Tzahi Idan, his coffee buddy, was kidnapped by Hamas and is still missing. Tired but determined, Mr. Freibach stood by a field of overripe peppers and the charred hulk of a $1 million tractor as he spoke. He's trying to rebuild but doesn't have a lot to work with. Hamas broke or stole much of his farm equipment. Insurance companies don't reimburse for assets lost in an act of war. So Mr. Freibach applied for government assistance. He received 45,000 shekels, which is around $12,400, for two older tractors. The new ones he bought on credit cost 360,000 shekels, almost $100,000. He took the financial risk, he said, because he wants to save the farm. Ms. Abraham is working to create an inventory of equipment stolen from the region, but isn't counting on the government to replace all that was lost. Through her initiative, Regrow Israel, she hopes philanthropy and civil society will help farmers fill the gaps. Attacks on Israel's environment and natural resources are not new. In 1965, the Palestine Liberation Organization's Fatah division made its terrorism debut with a failed attempt to blow up the national water carrier of Israel, which transfers water from the Sea of Galilee to other parts of the country. In 2005, Palestinian looters damaged approximately 900 out of 3,000 greenhouses Israelis left behind after they withdrew from Gaza. In 2018, terrorists launched more than 800 incendiary balloons from Gaza, setting fire to 6,100 acres of agricultural land in the Negev. Raids on the country's northern farms and arson in its forests have been regular occurrences. Agro-terrorism takes a heavy economic toll and is designed for maximum psychological and emotional effect. Hamas didn't just attack the land. It attacked Israel's blooming desert, a national symbol of innovation and resilience that lies at the heart of the idea of Israeli statehood. For now, residents of the western Negev have relocated to Israel's interior, but many plan to return. Some of the kibbutzim have waiting lists of families who want to join. Michal Uziyahu is liaison to the mayor of Eshkol region, a cluster of 32 communities that includes kibbutzim like Be'eri and the Nova Music Festival grounds. She says that more than 4,000 of Eshkol's 17,000 residents are already back. She is particularly moved by the return of 50% of the region's Thai workers. Some community members visit on the weekends just to smell their homes, she says. Today, there are 250 milking cows at Nahal Oz, though not near as many as before. Hamas killed at least 30 of them. Those that survived went unmilked for 9 days. Many developed mastitis, a painful condition that contaminates their milk, and killed another 70 of the herd. Some that have recovered still are not producing milk. Trauma from the sounds of explosions and gunfire, which Ms. Abraham calls the soundtrack of October 7, seems to have suspended their production. Mr. Freibach and his farmers will take care of them. Keeping busy is helping workers recover as well. Israel's first prime minister, David Ben-Gurion, once said that Israel's future lies in the Negev. Arbel Levin, chief business development officer of Mishke Hanegev Holdings, a consortium of the region's kibbutzim, agrees. He is from Eretz, a kibbutz with avocado orchards that abut the border fence with Gaza. The military evacuated the residents of Eretz, but Mr. Levin insists they will return when security returns to the area. Every meter that they give back to us, we will farm, he said. The region is going to flourish again. This is just the beginning. Well, the author of this piece, Miss Sugar, writes a column for the New York Sun and is author of the forthcoming novel, Everything is a Little Broken. Well, there you have a picture of Hamas's agricultural terrorism, the damage that was done, and how can you not notice that there's no international community crying for humanitarian aid for the area or for Israel? Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's just move along. We've got a time here for a little more. What do you suppose the ultimate aims of this war against Israel would be? Well, this is an essay by Alvin Rosenfeld, who is the director of the Institute for the Study of Contemporary Antisemitism, and his co-partner Irving Glazer, Chair in Jewish Studies at Indiana University. Well, they believe that the ultimate aims of the war against Israel would rival the worst horrors in our history. This essay starts with a photograph taken through a window of a safe room from the outside looking in. And you see large pools of blood stain on a child's bunk bed and the sheets inside this safe room. And this is on, this was after the attack on kibbutz in near Oz. That's the name of the kibbutz, near Oz, Israel, near the border of Gaza. Hamas's assault on Israelis October 7 wasn't an act of war as we normally think of it, but something far worse. There isn't an adequate term for what occurred that day, so people say things like terrorism, barbarism, atrocity, depravity, and so on. All are correct, but all fall short of capturing the annihilationist fury set loose at the Nova Music Festival and in the kibbutzim and small towns of southern Israel. The people attacked in those places were not only to die, but to die in torment. In addition to the merciless torture, killings, slashings, burnings, beheadings, mutilations, dismemberments, and kidnappings, there were gang rapes and other forms of sadistic sexual assault, including, according to some reports, cutting off women's breasts, nails driven into their thighs and groins, bullets fired into their vaginas, and intercourse even with female corpses. Unimaginable? For normal people, yes. But before going into Israel, the Hamas assassins were instructed to dirty them and to whore them. And that's exactly what many of them faithfully did. It's impossible to capture all the evil of that day in a single image, but it would be that of the violent seizure of a young Israeli woman, Naama Levy, 19 years old, barefoot, beaten and bloodied, her hands tied behind her back, the crotch of her sweatpants heavily soiled, possibly from being raped, dragged by her hair at gunpoint into a Hamas car, then driven off to Gaza to suffer an unspeakable fate among her captors. Her assailants filmed every second of her ordeal, and as one watches the clips of her being taken away, one sees crowds nearby loudly shouting, "Allahu Akbar," Allah is the greatest, a victory cry that offers religious sanction to the evil, malign treatment of Naama Levy and countless others seized, slaughtered, and abducted on that horrific day. All wars cause human suffering, but the cruelties visited upon Israelis on October 7 far surpass what normally happens when armies go to war. Hamas actions had a different aim, not conquest, but the purposeful humiliation of Jews by people who detest them and were sworn to degrade and dehumanize them before murdering them. For those familiar with Jewish history, the mass violence enacted against Jews in Kishinev in 1903 came instantly to mind, as did the Farhud in Iraq in 1941, and Khmelnytsky's savage decimation of Ukrainian Jewish communities in the mid-17th century. With memories of those earlier massacres newly revived, October 7 instantly evoked the word pogrom, with cause. How could this occur in today's Israel? The country's military is hailed as one of the strongest in the world and is regarded as invincible. But on that day, it failed to protect its southern border and present this ruthless assault on Jews in what's called the Gaza envelope. One woman summed up the reactions of virtually every Jew in the country and millions of others abroad when she said simply and incontrovertibly, "Every Israeli's worst nightmares have come true." Well, Hamas originates as a branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. It is, and has always been, a jihadist organization which sees the existence of Israel as an intolerable intrusion into what they call the domain of Islam, Dar al-Islam, and is committed to removing Israel by whatever means necessary. The preamble to the Hamas Charter declares Israel exists and will continue to exist until Islam obliterates it as it has obliterated others before it. The Palestinian problem, it affirms, is a religious problem not amenable to a negotiated political settlement. The only way to raise the banner of Allah over every inch of Palestine is through jihad, a holy war that is a duty for every Muslim wherever he may be. Where does this leave Israel? Well, right now a war with Hamas in Gaza and a simmering battle with Hezbollah in the north that could rapidly explode into a full-scale, even more fearsome war. What is at stake, as most Israelis understand it, is nothing less than the survival of the state itself. And Hamas spokesmen have said as much. Ghazi Hamad, a representative of Hamas, declared on a Lebanese TV station that the October 7 attack is just the first. There will be a second, a third, a fourth, until Israel is annihilated. Iran is sworn to finish off the criminal Zionist entity. It inscribes on its newest ballistic missiles with the words "Death to Israel" in Hebrew. As far back as 2001, Hashem Rafsanjani, then president of Iran, boasted the use of even one nuclear bomb inside Israel will destroy everything. Well, it looks like every Israeli's worst nightmares are indeed coming true. Reactions vary, of course, but people are marking this, and they're looking, and Israel refuses to be cowed, and people that are identifying strongly as Jews have stepped forward. Hamas set out to reverse as forcefully as possible what it did on October 7. Its murderous deeds that day were meant to debase and kill Jews and rally others to collectively put an end to the Jewish state, a strategic objective that recalls some memorable words of the Hungarian Jewish writer and Holocaust survivor Imre Kertész. The anti-Semite of our age no longer loathes Jews. He wants Auschwitz. Today's most passionate anti-Semites continue to loathe Jews for that very reason. They want Auschwitz. If Israelis were not aware of this before, they surely know it now. They also know one Holocaust is one too many and are committed to doing whatever they must to make sure there will not be a repeat. They need and deserve all the support we can give them. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's Longing for Auschwitz by Alvin Rosenfeld. With that, we are about out of time, and I want to thank you for joining me today for readings of interest to the Jewish community and remind you, my name is Michael Wolin. I like to wish all of you a good Shabbos, a Shabbat Shalom, and Shavua Tov. Have a good week.